I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys.
Coming up this week on The Trade Guys, we'll talk critical minerals, CBAM, and AGOA, all on the next episode of The Trade Guys. Trade Guys, I am glad to be back. I've shaken my nasty cold and trying to shake the allergies. It is pollen season here in D.C. Man, oh man.
You've been on injured reserve for some time here.
I've been on injured reserve, I know. It's when you have no voice, it is very hard to address the Trade Guys.
Glad to have you back in the starting order.
Thank you, sir. And I wanted to ask you guys, because this has been burning in my brain, about critical minerals. And why are countries from Europe to Asia clamoring to sign critical minerals agreements or CMAs with the U.S.?
Well, they want to share the market. I mean, it's business, you know. The Inflation Reduction Act sets up substantial incentives for EVs and some other things, but specifies the parts and components and the minerals, A, can't come from China, and B, if they're coming from somewhere other than the United States, have to come from a country with which we have a free trade agreement, an FTA. And I made this point in other contexts. One of the ironies of this, Congress never got around to defining what an FTA is. And I can blame myself partly because back in the 80s, when I was doing this in the Trade Act of 87, we didn't bother to do that. So the term has been undefined ever since. And it has come up, and the IRA doesn't define it either. And it has come up in a big way with these critical minerals agreements, because we have FTAs with countries like Chile and Australia that are major mineral suppliers. So good on us, good on them. But we have other countries that want to be integrated into our supply chains that have resources, either the minerals or refining capacity, that don't have FTAs with us. And what the administration did once was negotiate just a CMA, a critical minerals agreement with Japan. And then they're calling it an FTA. And that has led other countries to line up to try to do the same thing. The EU, where negotiations are fairly advanced. The Philippines is talking about it. Indonesia has said something about it. There are, I think, other countries that are thinking about it as well. And it's trying to get a share of what they anticipate will be a large market here, mostly for battery minerals. So at the same time, there's been a negative congressional reaction on two grounds. One, that they weren't consulted on the Japan agreement, and the Japan agreement was not submitted to them for approval. And I think the congressional view is that anything that looks like a trade agreement and quacks like a trade agreement ought to be submitted to Congress for approval. And that one wasn't. So the administration did a bad thing. But they also make the point that it's not really a free trade agreement, because free trade agreements are supposed to cover substantially all trade. And this doesn't. None of these do. They only cover minerals. So there's tension in Congress. And it reached the point last week when the House Ways and Means Committee voted out a bill for the first time defines FTAs, and the definition is predictable. It says it has to cover substantially all trade, which would rule out the future critical minerals agreements that are being negotiated, including the one with Europe, and it says they have to be approved by Congress. So Congress is asserting its authority and is trying to define these things really from a purist point of view, by saying the way it's the WTO definition of free trade agreement. It covers substantially all trade. So it's not some lunatic, strange definition. It's the mainstream definition. But minerals agreements don't cut it. And so if the bill passes, which I think is problematic, but if the bill passes, I think it would preclude reaching the agreement with Europe and with other countries. I don't know if it, I don't think it's retroactive. So I think the Japan one will stick, but it will, if it does pass, it'll prevent, I think, future agreements, unless we're prepared to do the whole nine yards and do a real FTA. And that will slow down our transition to greener technology because it'll restrict our access to minerals.
Well, look, Bill's right about the origin of this, which is the subsidies associated with these battery production or electric vehicle production, whatever is combined there. In the first year of the Biden administration, there were three major bills passed, all of which had massive subsidy components in them: the American Recovery Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. And all three of those, they totaled up to about $6 trillion in incremental spending. I recall there was a cover of The Economist magazine that had President Biden on it, and they called him the $6 trillion man. And so it's, you know, it's a lot of dough, and there's always, if you're in the, anywhere close to a business that is within the context of receiving subsidies, you're going to try to go for that. And that's certainly what's happened worldwide. I do think Congress meant what it said about free trade agreements. And there are 20 countries with whom the United States has a trade agreement that is substantially all trade. Many of them have important mineral sectors. Bill mentioned Chile and Australia. I'd add Canada and Peru and several other Latin American parties, including Mexico, all of which have substantial mineral sectors and could benefit from close relations with the producers in the United States through the all the other things that are in a free trade agreement. So we'll see if they sort it out. I mean, one of the things that happens when you get close to the end of a four-year administration or get close to presidential election, you find out that executive agreements are a lot like executive orders. They tend to be written in disappearing ink. And so if you can get them in some, what looks like a final form before the personnel changes, whether it's within Biden's second term or a Republican president instead of President Biden, there are always changes and you want to try to nail it down. I think that's what's happening now.
So you guys mentioned that there's a number of roadblocks or potential roadblocks that the Biden administration may face in Congress. I want to ask you about those. And then also I want to ask you about a new proposal from Ways and Means on defining a free trade agreement. How does that fit into this picture?
Well, it would shut off most of the negotiations. Well, there's only one negotiation going on, and that's with the EU.
Right.
There's a number of wannabe countries that have suggested they're interested too, including the Philippines. USTR is not taking anybody else up on the offer. So it's not clear to me how anxious the administration is to actually do these things to begin with. But the Japan one got everybody riled up in Congress. And the EU negotiation has been going on now, I would say, for a year or so without conclusion. The relevant commissioner, Gladys Dombrovskis, spoke on this last week at a press meeting and said that it was almost finished and the substance was finished. And what was left was political will to conclude, which I thought had been the problem from the beginning. So I'm not sure how much progress they've really made, but we'll see. I think the bill, the bill is going to stir up a lot of people. Dombrovskis was asked about it, and he said he needed to talk to the administration, to people on the Hill about it, which was probably the safest thing to say. I'm not sure what the bill's chances are. The bills were not bipartisan. The committee acted on, I think, six bills altogether, and they were all passed on more or less party line votes. I think this particular one got a couple of Democrats. I don't remember what the breakdown was. Most of them were party line. And they were party line for a couple reasons. One was, as often happens on the Hill, the not invented here syndrome. You know, the Democrats said, you didn't consult with us. You didn't talk to us. You didn't take our language. So we're going to vote against your bill, even though they might support the bill. The more important reason, because people get over that in time, the more important reason was there was a bill that was not taken up last week, and that was renewal of trade adjustment assistance, which is a program that provides assistance to workers who lose their jobs because of trade, which is a program that dates back to the 60s. And it's a program that the Democrats support, Republicans have been much less willing to support over time. And in the past, recent past, not total past, but in the past 10 years or so, it's tended to be linked to trade promotion authority, which is authority for the administration to negotiate new agreements, which expired this time around in June of 2021. And the Republican attitude is the two are linked. So no TPA, no TAA. And the administration has not sought renewal of trade promotion authority. And so it's dead for the time being. And the Republicans say, if you're going to kill that and not negotiate any new agreements. And remember, we've got a lot of Republicans, mostly from agriculture states, who would like to see new trade agreements negotiated, free trade agreements negotiated. The administration is not doing that. And so they're saying, well, if you're not going to do that, we're not going to reauthorize TAA. TAA is a big Democratic priority. And they said, if you're not going to do that, we're going to oppose all your bills. And so there it sits. You know, the full committee voted them out with the slim majority they've got. I don't know if they'll ever get to the floor. If they get to the floor, I don't know that they'll pass. We'll see. And even if they do pass, I think in the Senate, which the Democrats control, TAA will be back, and then there will be an effort to see if they can cut a giant deal, and maybe after the election, but I don't expect anything before that.
You know, when it comes to minerals, it strikes me that one of the amendments that might come up or that bill to make it to the Senate would be from Senator Dan Sullivan of Alaska, and he'd want to include the Commerce Clause as qualifying as a free trade agreement, because Alaska happens to have a fairly large share of the Earth's crust. And a lot of the minerals, the very minerals that are needed for the production of batteries and other devices that are part of this renewables economy and part of the plans to get to net zero. And yet the Interior Department is blocking most of the mining operations in a state. So I don't know. Senator Sullivan's a good guy. He's a friend of CSIS, former Assistant Secretary of State, understands the issues as well as the international issues. But
someone who works across the aisle, which is why he's friends with CSIS.
Yes, but he's like, he's got to be saying, hey, what about us? you want a minerals agreement with Europe, and you're blocking off extraction done the American way in Alaska. How about that?
Well, speaking of all that, let's talk about the recent climate task force that was established by the White House. Is the task force going to accomplish anything meaningful, or is this more of a symbolic action ahead of November?
Well, you know, it's a great mystery. John Podesta, who is succeeding John Kerry as the, I don't know what you call him, the climate envoy.
Climate czar.
We don't use czar anymore, Andrew. It's become a bad word.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I'm not sure why, but we had too many of them for a while. I think in Obama, we had so many of them that people started making fun of the czar role. And so it kind of fell out of favor. Of course, you'd think that Trump, with his relationship with Putin, would want to have more czars, but he didn't.
So anyway,
couldn't resist. Sorry.
Anyway. Let's not forget that Tariff Man was the inspiration for this very show, The Trade Guys.
Yes,
this is true.
Our careers in podcasting to President
if he
Trump.
Comes back, maybe so. We'll have to go to twice a week. You never know.
You never know.
Anyway, Podesta gave a speech at Columbia University last week in which he said that they're going to create a climate task force at the White House. And so far, nobody seems to know what he meant, and nobody seems to know anything about it. Ambassador Tai was asked about it a day later when she testified also last week before the Ways and Means of the Finance Committee. I forget which time it came up. And she said that all she knew about it was that she was on it, but she didn't know anybody else that was going to be on it. And so it's a bit of a mystery so far. There seems to be some tactical analysis about it, because what Podesta also said was that we're ready to deepen dialogue with our partners and allies around the world, from the UK to Australia to the EU, as it pursues its carbon border adjustment mechanism. Some people have interpreted that as a statement that we need to get out of the strict EU-US relationship on border adjustment measures, and we need to expand the conversation to cover more people because we're not getting anywhere with the EU. And it may well be that what this task force turns out to be is an effort to do that, to broaden the conversation beyond the one that's going on right now in the sustainable steel and aluminum agreement negotiations with the EU, which have been, as we've said before, which have been punted until after the election. So an area where, you know, we're not making a lot of progress with the EU, where we want to be, apparently want to be exempt from the CBAM, their CBAM. They don't want to let us do that for obvious reasons. They think what we want to do is not WTO compliant, which is proof once again that there's no WTO rule against hypocrisy, since the EU isn't bothered by WTO rules when they find them inconvenient. But in this particular case, it's convenient to rely on the WTO. So
this is a good idea that is Washington is famous for, capitals are famous for, because it is actually conceptually very attractive idea. A CBAM, for the audience's memory jogging, is a carbon border adjustment measure. And it's a way to without discriminating against the way products are produced, you essentially make it easier to trade in lower carbon products. In other words, products with a smaller carbon footprint. It's insanely attractive because it gets right at the issue. But like many concepts that are popular in Washington and Brussels and Geneva, places like that, is they're almost insanely difficult to implement and to agree on what even the numbers mean. Now, the idea is they're going back to something that really works in trade negotiation, which is if you can get to a number, you can facilitate bargaining. So if you take a whole range of products and you can identify and agree on what the carbon content is, the carbon footprint of those goods are, and you can agree on numbers associated with those goods, then the negotiation is based on the numbers. You say 21, the trading partner says 6, and you find somewhere toward 12 by the time you agree. Now, this is how tariff negotiations happen for years, and I learned from Bill's teaching partner, a friend of the show, Susan Schwab, former USTR, that a lot of her idea for a lot of quotas and border measures were to, quote, tariffize them, end quote. In other words, calculate them, those measures, which are non-tariff measures, but formulate them as tariffs so you can more easily negotiate with other parties. So it's a really good idea. The problem is the carbon footprint of any given good is insanely complex. And so I think USTR is going to have to find the rabbinical schools in the United States and hire some of the graduates to have these long involved discussions about, you know, what is the carbon content of this good.
Yeah, these are like Talmudic discussions here.
They are. And you know, the only place it really works is in taxes. The value added tax, which is a border adjustable measure, okay, works like a charm because everybody calculates taxes the same way. And they've managed to harmonize it there. But get any more complicated in the way something's composed, it's ugly. So,
but the answer in this case is what you said about taxes, to calculate in the same way. You begin this process with a global agreement on how to measure carbon content. And there's some private sector groups that have actually done that. Typically, each one is different. And what we need to have happen is countries to get together and agree on one, or create a new one. If everybody counts it the same way, then you're not going to have a lot of arguments. If people do it differently, then you create arguments about protection. So the EU says, well, the American way of calculating is designed to favor their industries at our expense. We say the same thing about the CBAM. It's designed to give European companies a pass and to tax the importers. And it's just protectionist. So if you have a common method of counting, which we don't, you solve a lot of those problems. And that should be the first step. I don't see the U.S. government doing a lot right now to try to make that happen, I mean, the data is there, the vehicles are there, the information is there. I mean, it's harder than I'm suggesting, because there's, you could have, you get Talmudic arguments, as Andrew said, about what should be in and what should be out when you count. And if you're an environmentalist, you feel very, very strongly about that.
But you also get innovation, and you get different kinds of products and new methods that weren't around when the initial calculation was created. Okay. And you have a tough time accommodating for them. So,
which means you always have to be recalibrating your standards,
yes.
but you begin there. The other piece of the argument that makes it difficult is the WTO rules say, the national treatment provision of WTO rules say, you got to treat the foreigners the same way you treat the domestics. So if you're going to have a CBAM, which taxes imports based on their carbon content, you also have to tax your equivalent domestic producers based on their carbon content. The Europeans claim that their CBAM, Carbon Border Adjustment Measure, will do that. Since nobody has to pay anything until 2026, it's kind of an academic question at this point. I think they'll be sued on that, and then we'll see what a WTO panel says. But they claim it's compliant. One of the U.S.'s problems is that we don't have a domestic price for carbon, and we don't have a domestic tax on carbon. So there's actually a proposal now, finally, in the Senate to do that. But it's a long, long way from an act.
Guys, we have enough time to talk about one of Scott's favorite subjects, AGOA. Scott, first tell us what AGOA is, and let's get into it. What is this renewal bill set out to do?
Well, AGOA is the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act. And Bill and I both cut our teeth in trade policy when trade was fairly controversial. And AGOA was a genuine relief because the political dynamics on AGOA were very different. Everybody wanted to do something positive for increasing trade in Africa. And it had always had a great bipartisan sense to it. There was a Pan-African consciousness in both the Congress and the administration, a desire to do something and build closer relationships through commerce with Africa. So that was always the positive idea, and it's always achieved fairly high levels of support. The disappointing side is it's never really produced much in terms of results. And while there's a series of modifications or proposed reforms to AGOA proposed by Senator Coons of Delaware and Senator Risch, it's a bipartisan proposal. It's, as AGOA has almost always been, bipartisan. But there's so little results to show over the years. It's one of these things that everybody hopes for the best, and we get pretty flat results. I've concluded that this goes back to the way AGOA was created and the ideas behind it. It's really a preference program that is very much like GSP, or the regional program that followed GSP was the Caribbean Basin Initiative. GSP was the generalized system of preferences. Now, those were 1970s in concept. And at that time, apparel had high quotas as well as tariffs. And so apparel was a very protected sector. And by giving relief to quotas on apparel, you could actually really produce some strong preferences that helped economies export to the United States in ways they couldn't without those preferences. We negotiated what was called the multi-fiber arrangement in the 1994 Uruguay round, and it was implemented in 2004. And by the time we were done, quotas had gone, and apparel was a lot cheaper, but preference programs didn't provide that much of an edge anymore. And we've had trouble with them working effectively ever since. I think that's the story with AGOA. I like the idea that a couple of senators who have leadership roles are thinking about it. What I'd ask them to think about is, what can we do to help Africa grow? That's the core question. And it may not be a trade preference program at the end of the day, but good motivation. We just need a better question.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's different in this bill, and why will this time be any different than the other times that you've just described?
Well, it reduces the review frequency. So instead of an annual review, there's biennial reviews. It tries to eliminate some of the burdens. It focuses it to a greater extent on supply chains, which Africa has internally focused on eliminating barriers between countries. The intra-Africa trade barriers are often quite staggering versus the extra-Africa or inter-Africa trade policies with the United States. So there's some good things. There's some ways to improve it. It's a little dial turn of what we have now. I'd rather see some reform thinking that's really radical and ask some very basic questions.
Yeah, tweaks. Yeah. I mean, they're good tweaks because under the current program, the president is required to review everybody's status every year, and this changes it to every 2 years, which provides a little bit more certainty, although it leaves open the idea of out-of-cycle reviews, which means if somebody's is mad at the country for any particular reason, they can ask the president to conduct an out-of-cycle review. I think one thing that it does that may be significant is the current law basically has only like one enforcement tool, and that is that if the president concludes that the country's not meeting its obligations, he kicks them out of the villa, period. And this bill would give the president more options. I mean, one of them would be terminating them, but another one would be terminating the benefits only for certain products. Another one would be a warning letter that benefits will be terminated the following year if they don't shape up. And another one would be that he can find that they haven't met their obligations, but we're not going to do anything about it because there are other U.S. interests that take precedence. So it gives the president more flexibility. As Scott said, it's also designed to promote economic integration inside Africa. It brings the Northern African, north of the Sahara, countries into this program and allows content that comes from them to count towards the value added requirement. 35% of the Algoa requires that 35% of a product's value has to originate in Africa. And this bill would allow North African content to contribute to that. This has been a sub-Saharan African program up until now. And it would also change the rules for income graduation, which I think it's something that I had never thought about till I read about it, that it has a standard clause for these things that if your country becomes too rich, then you don't get the benefits anymore. So if you become a high income country, according to the World Bank's measure, you lose your benefits. The problem, of course, is particularly with countries that are kind of on the margin of that, that if they lose the benefit, that is an economic blow to them. And the following year, they drop back down below the high income standard, and then they become eligible again. So then they're eligible, and then they get back up above the high income standard.
It's called a welfare cliff.
And so they ping pong back and forth.
Social policy.
Which does nobody any good. And so they've put in here that you have to, if you're going to lose your eligibility, you don't, on this ground, you don't lose it until you've been a high income country for 5 consecutive years. And in fact, the president can extend it for even an additional 5 years if he wants to. That doesn't happen a lot, but it adds a note of certainty, I think, for the participating African countries that they're not going to get basically jerked around if they're successful.
All right, guys. Well, we really buried the lead here today. Tonight, Thursday, the 25th, is NFL draft night. Scott, any early predictions?
Well, I'm always amazed at the size of the TV audience.
Huge.
For this, and you know, versus other live sporting events.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, not only tonight, but tomorrow night and then Saturday. And in fact, in our household, the Schwartz household, this is a very special draft because my oldest son's teammate is expected to go either in the third or the fourth round, and we're going to be attending a draft party with him on Saturday.
The thing I'm most interested in, Andrew, is this is held in the city of Detroit this year.
Yeah.
And the city has hired falconers to use falcons to drive out the pigeons to make Detroit a little less pigeon infested than
wow.
The normal downtown is. I think that's a very creative solution. And I'm very pro falcon, not the Atlanta Falcons, but the bird. So I'm interested to see how they do. It's one of those
kind
things.
It's a Darwinian solution.
That tickled my natural sciences myself.
Well, I got to say, I mean, to me, this is like watching paint dry. But if they're going to have videos of the Falcons attacking the pigeons, that's worth watching.
I'm sure that will be available somewhere, probably somewhere in the far reaches of YouTube. We'll find it for you, Bill.
Yes.
Guys, thanks a million, and we'll talk trade next week.
See you then.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to the Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.